This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The messaging has started already, urging everyone to get your flu shot this year. And although it's easy to underestimate the flu as just an unfortunate part of winter, the illness can be deadly, especially for young kids and older adults. So this year, these populations may see some changes in vaccination practice. We'll find out more this hour in The Exchange. And then later in our show, the lowdown on fall foliage. Will the drought wash out the colors from our beloved autumnal show? First, though, the flu. And let's get your questions and comments in about the illness itself or the vaccine. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests. Dr. Elizabeth Clardy is here, family doctor with Concord Family Medicine. Dr. Clardy, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's also an infectious disease physician. And Dr. Chan, welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, Dr. Chan, to you first, please. What are some of the common misunderstandings that people have about the flu?
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion about what is the flu and what's a common cold. You know, both of these are respiratory illnesses that are caused by different viruses. You know, the common cold has multiple different causes, multiple different viruses. The flu is caused by the influenza virus and typically causes a much more severe infection or can cause a much more severe infection. People with different colds or different viral infections can oftentimes have upper respiratory symptoms like runny nose, sore throat, cough. People with the flu tend to have more severe systemic symptoms, so just whole body not feeling well, having muscle aches, sometimes high fevers, headaches, extreme fatigue, in addition to some of the other symptoms like sore throat, runny nose, and cough. The flu is also responsible for some more serious complications every year, such as secondary bacterial infections like secondary pneumonias that people can get after getting the influenza virus infection. So it's not an insignificant infection, and it causes significant disease every year.
Well, somebody said the flu is the Rodney Dangerfield of illnesses, Dr. Chan, because it doesn't get the respect it deserves. What do you think?
You know, I think that's true to some extent. You know, I think people understand, though, that people understand that, you know, they don't want to get an infection, but they don't always understand the difference between the different types of infection that they can get. You know, every year the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that between 3,000 and 49,000 people die from the flu or influenza-related complications. You know, these are complications that can be prevented potentially by getting the flu vaccine.
Well, and that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. And, you know, and it's not just the risk of having complications from the flu and dying, but, you know, people can be out of work, kids that stay home from school and parents who need to take care of them, doctor's visits, lost work, lost time from recreation and vacations, that sort of thing.
So in addition to the deaths, lots of just serious disruptions to the normal flow of life.
That's right.
Dr. Clardy, what are some of the common questions that you get from your patients about the flu?
Well, one of the big things is it the flu or not? And like Ben was saying, I think classically you think of flu as it's like it hits you like a Mack truck. It's very sudden in onset, and the classic symptoms are fever, muscle aches, headache, and then the respiratory symptoms. And then some of the big questions are, should I come in and see the doctor? How long should I stay out of work? How long am I infectious? And people actually are shedding flu virus for a day or two before they get sick.
Oh, yikes.
And then all while they're sick, about 5 days, they shed the virus. So if you think about kids and how long they stay out of school or things like that, really you're infectious while you have the symptoms.
That's a long time to be infectious. And those 2 days before, you're carrying it around, shedding it, as you said, and you don't even know it.
Right, right. And then the other things are, should I take medication for the flu? What should I take? There are some medicines that can, if they're given early enough, within 48 hours of symptoms, can shorten symptoms for about a day. So they help a little bit, but we tend to focus those more on people that are at high risk for complications or are severely ill, hospitalized or something like that.
Who is at highest risk of being in that group of people who die from the flu that Dr. Chan mentioned?
So young children and people over 65, and then people with other illnesses. So people that have compromised immune systems like cancer or HIV/AIDS, people with lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, anyone that might have trouble handling secretion. So someone with a neuromuscular condition like cerebral palsy, people in nursing homes. The other groups that you don't think about are pregnant women, and also people that are severely obese with a BMI over 40. And again, it probably has to do with how they're handling secretions and things like that.
Well, I want to ask both of you about the flu vaccine because, boy, the messaging is out there. It seems early this year. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want your questions and comments about the flu illness itself, any questions you might have, and then the vaccine. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So here's a question that a lot of us actually on the exchange had. And I'll turn to you first, Dr. Chan. The messaging is out there. I went by a big poster just this morning on my way to work. How early is too early to get the flu vaccine?
That's a good question and one that we get quite a bit. And it's not always an easy question to answer. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that when we start to see the flu virus circulating in our communities, that's the time to go and get the flu virus vaccine. We released a notification last week that we have in New Hampshire identified influenza virus circulating within our communities. That's typical this time of year. We typically see flu around this time of year in September, October. So now is, in fact, the time that people should go and get the influenza vaccine. The CDC actually recommends that ideally people should get the vaccine by the end of October. The immunity to the vaccine, it's not a long-lasting immunity like some of the better vaccines we have. People should be protected for at least 6 to 8 months, possibly longer. But if people get immunized by the end of October, that should last them through the flu season, which goes typically till about April or May. It should cover them during the peak of the flu season, where in New Hampshire, that's in January or February. So I would say now is the time that people should think about going and getting the flu vaccine, both for themselves and their children. I just want to mention that, as was mentioned previously, there are a lot of people that would qualify as being at higher risk for influenza complications. You know, all the chronic diseases that are out there, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, people whose immune system aren't working, the very young and the very old. So there are a lot of people out there that should be thinking seriously about getting the flu vaccine. You know, I think one of the misconceptions is, you know, well, growing up, I had the flu. I did just fine. I don't need the flu vaccine. You know, and the recommendations change over time. And so the move is to try and get more people vaccinated rather than less, both to protect yourself, but also to protect people around you whose immune system, for example, may not be working. And so this is a very important public health intervention. And one of the best ways, the flu vaccine is one of the best ways to prevent yourself from getting the flu, but also to protect other people.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit more about that, too. But in terms of the vaccine and how long it lasts, Dr. Clardy, I was just talking to a colleague this morning who said last year, I'm sure you've heard stories like this, last year I got vaccinated pretty early in the season. And then in April, I got the flu. So she was wondering, did it wear off?
It can wear off. So the average is sort of 4 to 6 months that it lasts. And it's not always 100% effective either. So we see this especially like in nursing homes where we immunize everyone, but you'll still sometimes see flu. So sometimes the flu doesn't match, it mutates. And so the virus, they started making the vaccine to this virus a year ago, and in that year the flu strains might have changed, and so it might have been a mismatch. So sometimes we don't do as well with how the vaccine works, and sometimes it might have been too early.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because that's always been interesting and yet frustrating, Dr. Chan. You know, you get your flu vaccine and you still get the flu, but it's worth noting that the vaccine isn't 100% effective. It's not like, you know, smallpox or, you know, polio vaccines.
That's right. And I think the flu vaccine is determined every year well before we actually have flu circulating in our communities. So world public health partners like the World Health Organization, the WHO, and the CDC convene around February of every year to decide what the next season's flu vaccine is going to include. And they make that determination by looking at their worldwide surveillance data and what types of strains are circulating around the world, not just in the United States, so that the companies that produce the flu vaccine can ramp up production and have the vaccine ready by the end of summer, beginning of fall, for people to get the flu vaccine. You know, unfortunately, that's not always, you know, 100% accurate, that prediction back in February. And so you do sometimes have mismatch between what the vaccine includes and what strains are circulating. You know, last year there was a relatively good match. The predominant virus that we saw last year was the H1N1 flu virus. Now, H1N1 is just a name for the type of flu that we see. We also saw some H3N2 influenza virus. Both of these were found in the flu vaccine last year, and so there was a relatively good match.
How do you convince people, Dr. Clardy, to get the vaccine anyway, even if it's not 100% effective, and in some years it's maybe only, you know, 50%?
I think that's it's a hard sell sometimes. I find most often people are motivated to get the flu vaccine if they've had a bad case of flu, or if they have people they care about. So I find often I'll have someone that has turned me down flat until they have grandkids. And then they'll be willing to get it because they want to protect the baby.
That's a long wait.
Right, right.
By the time someone has grandkids.
But if someone is a caregiver for someone that has cancer or an older person, I often find they're much more motivated. But then a lot of times parents with young kids that just don't want to have miss work for a week taking care of the kids and then maybe be sick themselves, that's often a motivation. So, you know, we just kind of chip away at it, but it sometimes is a hard sell. But for the most part, I think people find that it is effective and they appreciate that, you know, they've missed a serious illness. And then after they get in the habit of getting it, it hasn't been a big deal to keep on getting the vaccine every year.
So you recommend universal vaccination almost, Dr. Clardy?
I do. It is recommended for everyone over 6 months of age. And part of that is because the more people get it, the more the people that are at serious risk don't get exposed to the flu. And that's really what's beneficial. So sometimes it's hard to convince a 20-something, you know, to get a vaccine for an illness that's inconvenient but not terrible for them. But really, as a community, if we all get the vaccine, it helps the people that are at highest risk.
So that invincible 20-something probably just miss work for a week if he or she gets the flu, but he or she could seriously impact someone else who has a compromised immune system.
Exactly.
Or has a little baby or
right.
Whatever.
Or even the person that gets the flu and goes back after a couple days and frankly is still sharing the virus with all their coworkers. And then everyone else gets the flu at work. And so the more you can prevent the spread, the better for the community.
The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us. We're taking your questions, comments, thoughts, concerns about the flu this year and the vaccine, 1-800-892-6477. And go ahead, Dr. Chan, I can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that one of the common misconceptions that we oftentimes hear for people that don't want to get the flu vaccine is either they got the flu vaccine and then got the flu. That the flu vaccine gave them the flu.
Right.
You know, and I just want to mention that the flu shot can't give you the flu. It's a dead vaccine. So people will sometimes have some symptoms afterwards, pain or redness at the site of the shot, not feeling well, generalized fatigue, feeling a little run down. That's normal if somebody feels that way after the flu shot. That's the body responding to what was given to them and having an immune response to give them immunity to the flu. The other side of that is that some people say, well, I got the flu shot and I got the flu anyway later in the season. And as we talked about, certainly that can happen. You know, the flu shot is not 100% effective. But also there's a lot of other viruses circulating this time of year. There are enteroviruses and rhinoviruses and respiratory syncytial virus or RSV. These are common other types of viruses that can cause symptoms of runny nose, cough, sore throat, like we talked about in the beginning. So it's certainly possible that somebody can get the flu shot and then still get the flu or get another type of infection that people might get confused with the flu. But, you know, again, every year the flu vaccine is a little bit different, but we still encourage people to get it.
You're making me really excited about the coming of winter, Dr. Chan, listing all those viruses. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, let's go to the phones. Sherry's joining us from Concord. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Perfect timing. So the flu vaccine, you know, it's out there and everyone gets it pretty much, and it seems like it's so harmless. You know, last season, an acquaintance of mine, a very healthy woman in her 60s, who would hike and do all these things, got the flu vaccine and then ended up with chronic COPD, and now she's oxygen dependent. And she said, and again, I know every situation is unique and I don't know her whole health history, but even though the risks are so small, you know, given me pauses here to, you know, to really think about getting my flu shot. I'm like, oh my God, what are the risks, you know, rare but serious risks?
And Sherry, you said COPD, is that right?
Yeah, it was like a chronic COPD. Now she's on oxygen and she's, you know, can't engage in the physical activities she used to engage in.
Wow.
And she said it was from the vaccine.
Well, Sherry, like what a shame. And I feel so bad for your friend. Go ahead, Dr. Chan.
Yeah, and that sounds like an unfortunate situation. And, you know, unfortunately, not knowing the person or knowing the case, we couldn't discuss it on the air anyway, so I can't comment on that specific case. You know, COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is a chronic lung condition. Most of the time, COPD comes from exposure to things like tobacco smoking. You know, it's hard to say that something like that was due to the flu vaccine itself. But again, everybody has, you know, each case is sort of different, and unfortunately, we can't discuss individual cases like that.
Well, Sherry, thank you for calling in. You know, Dr. Claudia, something Sherry said. She said pretty much everyone gets the flu vaccine. Does everyone pretty much get it?
Unfortunately, not. Some people are better than others. We encourage everyone to get it, but not everyone does. I do stress to people that the vaccine is the same whether you get it at the pharmacy or our office. And so I think it is one where convenience is important. And wherever you can get it, from the visiting nurse, at work, at school, at the pharmacy, at your doctor's office, it's more important to get it.
Yeah, so. And go ahead, Dr. Chan, too. Is everybody getting it? I heard vaccination rates for adults is dropped a little bit.
Well, so we actually don't really know what the vaccination rates are for adults. That's not something that's reportable to the state public health department. It's not something that we track. The one measure that we do oftentimes measure is the number of healthcare providers that get vaccinated in order to protect our patient population at our hospitals. I think last year the healthcare provider vaccination rate throughout New Hampshire was about 93%, so very good. But for the general population, we really don't know. And a lot of our focus is on trying to make the vaccine accessible and available to people so that they can choose to go and get the flu vaccine in a very convenient way.
You know, I've seen, as I said earlier, a lot of campaigns. It seems like a little earlier this year, although maybe it's the same with Christmas and Halloween decorations. They seem to come out earlier every year. What kind of a difference do you think, Dr. Clardy, these campaigns have made?
I think it is helpful.
You know, do it for the ones you love and
yes,
all that.
I think that's really a big motivator. So I think those are good. And I think the more you can see it out, frankly, when you go to the pharmacy and see the signs your flu shots are here. I agree. Sometimes it does seem in August. It's a little early. But I think that's better than not having it out there and reminding people to get it.
Have you heard from patients that, you know, I didn't get it before, but boy, seeing all those signs around, you know, again, grandpa with his arm around the granddaughter, do it for the ones you love. Does that make a difference?
I haven't had anyone personally say that to me, but I think it maybe subliminally gets people thinking about it.
What do you think, Dr. Chan? What kind of a difference have these campaigns made? They certainly do seem to be stepped up in recent years.
Yeah, I would agree that, yes, there are more campaigns than there certainly used to be. Again, unfortunately, it's not something we track in terms of the utilization of some of these programs. But, you know, each community may have their own influenza vaccination program. Some schools may offer influenza vaccination. I think the benefit of living in New Hampshire is that we tend to have very good vaccination rates all around. One of the reasons for that is that we are what's called a universal vaccination state, where we actually provide vaccine for kids free of charge for everybody. So any kid can walk into their healthcare provider's office or to one of these flu clinics or somewhere you can get the flu vaccine and get the flu vaccine for free if they don't have insurance. You know, this is provided through funding from various organizations. And so the public health department purchases flu vaccine and sends it to providers. And so people should be able to get the flu vaccine without any barriers.
You know, I also read about a different flu vaccine this year, a more amped up flu vaccine for older adults to bolster their immune response since they are, as you both said, more susceptible to having complications from the flu and dying from it. And I'd love to hear from both of you on this. Maybe you first, Dr. Chan, is there a new flu vaccine this year for older Americans?
Well, every year there's a variety of different options for flu vaccines, and they all go by different names, and they all have different sort of indications for who should get it and what age range. So there's not a new flu vaccine necessarily, but there is always different formulations of the flu vaccine. And one of the options is a double dose vaccine, so double the antigen of the virus. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention doesn't recommend one flu vaccine over another, but I think that this highlights that there are many options out there. And, you know, the recommendation is for everybody 6 months or 6 months of age or older to get the flu vaccine, whether they have a medical contraindication, which is very few people. Most people should be able to find a flu vaccine that is right for them. And if people have questions about this or concerns, they can talk to their healthcare provider. But there isn't one vaccine that's recommended over another one.
Okay, but so there are different vaccines for different types of people, Dr. Clardy? I didn't realize that.
Yes, although this year there's a big change. There used to be a nasal spray vaccine. Well, there still is for people under age 49. But in the last few flu seasons, it has not been as effective. So it's not recommended this year. And that's going to be a big issue, I think, for parents with kids, because kids had been, I think, more accepting of getting a nasal spray rather than a shot. And unfortunately, that is not going to be an option this year.
More on this year's flu season, what to expect and how to prepare in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, warnings have begun already about the flu this year. We're finding out more, including what's different about the flu vaccine this year. And let's hear from you, your questions about the how and why and what of this illness and the shot that aims to prevent it. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us your questions on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's also an infectious disease physician. Also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Clardy, family doctor with Concord Family Medicine. A couple of emails I want to share with both of you. Here's one from Stephanie in Kensington. She says, I would be interested to hear if it matters where we get the flu shot. Should we go to our primary care doctor, pediatrician for my 2.5-year-old, or is it okay to just get at the local pharmacy? It seems like a lot of stores are offering this service. Are those legitimate places to go? She's right, Dr. Chan. It does seem to be everywhere. You know, pick up your groceries and get your flu shot at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's that may be part of the confusion. There's so many different options out there, not only for which flu vaccine to get, but also where to get it. For most people, it's not going to matter where they go. You know, the flu vaccine that's being given at a pharmacy or a free flu clinic or a doctor's office, you know, different formulations, but it should still provide protection. There are certain individuals that may want to talk to their healthcare provider about getting the flu vaccine from them, and those are people that may be concerned, may not be feeling well before they get the flu vaccine, or those who have an egg allergy. You know, there are even for those who do have an egg allergy, most of the times there is a flu vaccine that somebody can get that they won't react with. So there are certain individuals that may want to talk to their healthcare provider, but for most people, it shouldn't matter where they get the flu vaccine.
Well, and the big headline this year, and I know we've touched on it, but is, Dr. Clardy, no flu mist for the kids this year? I have a 12-year-old who is very disappointed that there's no flu mist this year. Now, how come there's no flu mist?
Well, unfortunately, the flu mist hasn't been as effective the last few flu seasons. So they're not recommending it because it doesn't seem to be working. And you're right. It had made it much easier to convince parents of kids to get a vaccine when it's a flu mist rather than a shot.
I heard that in Canada they're still doing the flu mist.
Dr.
Chan, have you heard anything about that?
I'm not sure about that situation.
Okay.
You know, I can say that is one of the big changes to the recommendations from the CDC this year, is that the flu mist is not recommended. As Dr. Clardy mentioned, it's still out there. Back in, you know, over the spring and summer, the manufacturers had to ramp up production, so they produced the flu mist vaccine. That's the nasal spray. But the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, this is the group, the CDC group that puts out recommendations about flu vaccine every year, around June of this year recommended not using the flu mist because the last two seasons it has shown to not be as effective as the shot. Now, this obviously, I think, produces some confusion because, you know, three or four flu seasons ago, it was actually recommended over the shot.
Really?
Yes. That was back in, I believe, the 2014 flu season. There was a recommendation to actually use the flu mist, the nasal spray, over the shot in children especially because it looked like it was probably more effective. But then when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention went back and looked at the last two seasons, it was not as effective as the flu shot. So we don't know why this is. They're not sure what exactly is going on. It may be some issue with the stability of the vaccine. But this year, the flu mist, the nasal spray, is not recommended. And so unfortunately, it's going to be the shot for people that have to go and get for people that go and get the flu vaccine.
So how is that going to change things at your office, Dr. Clardy?
Well, it's unfortunate. So what we have found is that, you know, I think for most kids, if they know what's coming without a lot of drama, they really do fine. I think that you don't want to sneak up on them and, you know, poke a needle in them without them being prepared. But on the other hand, being fairly matter of fact about it helps. I think the words parents use, you know, so not saying, you know, they're going to give you a shot and it's going to hurt. Or sometimes parents in the office will say, you better be good or the doctor will give you a shot. And, you know, it kind of
that doesn't help you very much.
Right.
Doesn't
help. So sometimes you can use words like it might be a little pinch or a poke or, you know, using less emotionally laden words. And then the other thing that we try to do is distract while the child's getting the shot. So sometimes we'll do things like have them blow bubbles or blow a pinwheel. Or frankly, take your iPod or your phone and have them look at a video or, you know,
the one
something.
Time the doctor recommends screen time.
Right. Screen time is great during your flu shot. If kids are really phobic about shots, there is a prescription numbing cream that you can ask for. And you'd put it on usually about an hour before you're going to get the shot. And that does numb the skin. So if a kid is really just frantic, that can be helpful. But for the most part, I think if you just treat it kind of matter-of-factly, make it quick, distract, they do fine.
A little bribery.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, bribery is – that's another time bribery is good.
Well, and are you concerned, Dr. Clardy, that this will cause a drop-off in the number of kids getting vaccinated?
I am. Because
really?
I think the flu mist, they were giving it and some of the schools were giving it, and I don't – I don't know yet, but I can imagine that they may not want to be doing a lot of injections at schools, whereas the Flumist was pretty well accepted. So we'll just have to see.
Dr. Chan?
Yeah, so, you know, the public health department does help to make flu vaccine available through schools, and, you know, certain schools sign on and allow the flu vaccine to be given. So that is an option. There will still be, for those towns and those schools that elect to have or host a flu vaccination clinic at schools, that will still be occurring this year. Unfortunately, it won't be with the Flumist vaccine, so it'll have to involve a shot. You know, I think sometimes that can be a benefit, not only because it makes the vaccine more available to children, it gives parents an option so they don't have to, you know, take them out of school or drag them into the doctor's office to get the flu shot. But, you know, I think when kids are around their peers, sometimes they tend to be a little more brave. So that may be an option for parents that don't want to have to bring them to the doctor's office to get the flu shot. There are other accessible spots within the community, within school systems, to get the flu vaccine.
Sometimes it's easier to be less dramatic when you're not with mom and dad.
That's right.
When you're around your friends, you have to be a little bit more stoic. All right. Well, again, the exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, concerns about the flu and the vaccine this year. As we're hearing, every year it's a little bit different. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Put your questions there. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And both of you, here's an email from Rachel who says, you keep stating the flu vaccine is not 100% effective. But Rachel says the whole truth is that the flu vaccine is only 50 to 60% effective. And she attaches a CDC link there in her email. She says, also, your guests are not in agreement on how long the vaccine lasts, 4 to 6 months or 6 to 8 months. Rachel says, none of this inspires much confidence in the flu vaccine. Rachel, thank you so much for the email. And Dr. Clardy, what do you think?
I think
uncertainty creates a lack of confidence.
It does. It does. And it is one of those things where sometimes what's best for one individual person is different from what's good for the community. And so when you're thinking about flu vaccine, we as medical providers are often thinking about what's better for the whole community. And if more people get a shot, even if it's not, you know, completely effective, you do get some herd immunity that helps, again, protect the people that are at highest risk. Whereas if you just think about it from my individual perspective, 50%, you know, what's the point and what's in it for me? So it does vary. And she's right. It's not a perfect vaccine. I wish we did have one. I wish we had one that lasted forever. But that's kind of the nature of flu. And it changes from year to year as far as how good it is.
Well, so that's why you need one every year, because unlike smallpox or polio or diphtheria, you know,
flu
changes.
Exactly. It mutates and it's constantly changing. So that's why some years it's, as Dr. Chan said, it's a very good match, and some years it's not.
It's kind of like playing darts almost, Dr. Chan. You know, you just throw the dart and hope it sticks.
Yeah, and I think your listener highlights some of the medical uncertainty around the flu vaccine. And, you know, she's right. There are areas that are uncertain when you get the flu vaccine. You know, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that, you know, the immunity lasts 6 to 8 months. In some people, that could be shorter. In some people, that may be longer. And, in fact, some individuals may have residual immunity to the strains of flu into the following this season. We don't think that immunity is enough to prevent the flu, so we recommend repeat vaccination every year, not only to boost the immune system, but also to immunize against potential changes to the flu vaccine. So as an example, this year, one of the major changes is that one of the strains has been altered from last year's vaccine. And so, you know, to get optimal protection, people should be getting the flu shot every year, both to boost their immune system and also to immunize them against these new strains that we find circulating in the community and around the world. I also want to make mention that, you know, she's right, the vaccine effectiveness, and there's different ways of measuring vaccine effectiveness. Normally, when people talk about vaccine effectiveness, they're talking about the ability of the flu vaccine to reduce healthcare visits, reduce hospitalizations, reduce the need to go see a physician or a family care practitioner. In a good year, the flu vaccine is about 60 to 70% effective at reducing, you know, clinically significant disease. Last year, the flu shot, so not the nasal mist, but the actual shot, was estimated in kids and adolescents to be about 63% effective. So your listener is right that it's not 100% effective. On a good year, it's about 60 to 70% effective. That's what the flu shot. That's how effective the shot was last year. We have to wait and see how effective this year's flu shot will be until, you know, some months into the flu season.
And there's no, as you said earlier, there's no mid-season booster. So if I got it again October 1st, by March 1st, we're still in flu season, but I'm worried that it might wear off.
Yeah, and I think most people probably think that the – most scientists, I should say, probably think that the flu vaccine, if you get it, you know, in October or by the end of October, should last you through the flu season.
Well, thank you again for the email, Rachel. And here's another one from Kyle. He says, this is where I have to disagree. Our bodies are meant to fight the flu. Our ancestors before us did fine without the flu shot. It's just doctors pushing another pharmaceutical product to make them money. I have heard this. Thank you, Kyle, so much. Dr. Claudia, I have heard this from some people. Our bodies are made to fight this. And, you know, that's what we're supposed to do.
Well, you're right. Our bodies do have an ability to fight it, and most people get uncomplicated flu and do okay, but a significant number of people die, and our ancestors also died. You know, we had younger death rates. And so for me to accept that, especially when I look at death rates among young infants and young children or older people, I don't think that's acceptable. So it is a natural process and we do get immunity, but I think that the flu vaccine really has a major benefit in terms of preventing serious death and disease among high-risk people.
Well, and if you're a lover of history like I am, you do read that people routinely lost a child or two in a family, and that may have been part of it.
Right.
Well, Kyle, thank you very much for the email. So, Dr. Chan, I did want to ask you another question about some questions about the vaccine, whether there's a booster, how effective it is. Some researchers have been looking at the question of repeated vaccines, that if you get the flu shot annually, the effectiveness goes down. This is another question that I came across doing my research yesterday, and I wonder if you know anything about that.
Well, I think it depends on how you define – it goes back to this, how you define effectiveness. I'm not aware of research that shows that the effectiveness goes down. There have been studies that look at the immune response, you know, checking antibody levels to the flu vaccine. And, you know, it's always unclear how antibody levels relate to, you know, somebody actually developing the disease. So, you know, as an example, we can check immune or antibody levels in somebody, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be immune or that they won't get disease. And so I think part of the confusion that you're bringing up may be around how you define effectiveness. And oftentimes there's a ceiling to how much your antibodies, your body will produce in response to a flu vaccine. And so if somebody keeps getting the flu shot every year, the increase in your antibody levels is not going to be as great likely. So for example, if you never got the flu shot, and then you got it for the first year, you're going to see probably quite a big rise in your antibody levels, as opposed to somebody that's had the flu before or had the flu vaccine in the past, and they get a new flu shot, and you look at the antibody level rise again. It may not be as great of a rise, but they may still be immune, meaning they, if exposed to the flu, they won't get disease. And so I think part of that question depends on how you – that's sort of a technical answer, but I think part of it depends on how you define effectiveness of the flu vaccine.
Well, and I wonder too, Dr. Clardy, you know, we're focusing so much on the vaccine, what it does, what it doesn't do. Over time, our own bodies change. And, you know, things that we used to be able to do, we can't do anymore. Or we used to never get allergies and all of a sudden we get allergies. So I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit, too. People's expectations that the flu vaccine will always do this year after year, even if they're 10 years older or 20 years older.
That's right. And so actually the nature of how flu, the symptoms of flu change. So young children who haven't had flu before are much more likely to have very high fevers, get febrile seizures or things like that.
Whereas, febrile seizure, what is that?
So when a fever rises rapidly in certain young children, they will get a seizure from that the high fever spiking.
Wow.
And so that's more of a risk in younger kids who haven't had an immune response to, or been exposed to flu before. Older people who've had the flu a lot often won't get all of the classic symptoms. They may not have as much high fever or things like that, but they may so we may miss the diagnosis at first because it's not kind of the classic. So definitely the way our bodies respond is different. And again, once you're older, the chances that you might have a more severe complication go up.
That's the thing. So you used to be able to withstand it a little bit more. And
exactly. Tough it out.
To the point that we had earlier from a listener, this is what our bodies do. We just have to deal with it. And that may be fine when you're 25, but not when you're 55.
Right. Or 85.
Yeah, right. Go ahead, Dr. Chan. Do you want to jump in there? That our bodies change and some of these frustrations that we're hearing from our listeners, it doesn't work or it worked a little or it made me sick.
Yeah, and I think the comment about our bodies are made to fight the flu, I mean, that's absolutely true. Our bodies are made to fend off and fight infection. The purpose of immunization is to use our body's natural response to try and prevent us from getting sick, prevent the complications. As was mentioned, as people get older, not only do their immune systems and their immune response goes down, but people also develop other medical complications, other medical conditions like heart disease, diabetes, COPD, or asthma that was mentioned previously in the call. People become, you know, more overweight. All of these medical conditions combine to put people at higher risk for serious complications of the flu, like hospitalizations, death, you know, serious disease or impairment.
Well, both of you, lots to think about. And I want to thank you both very much for being here. And I'll remember this conversation as I see all those signs all over town at the grocery store and everywhere. Thank you both so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Betsy Clardy, it was good to see you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Clardy, family doctor with Concord Family Medicine. Dr. Benjamin Chan, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services, also an infectious disease physician. Ahead, from the flu to foliage, we'll get the forecast for our annual spectacle this time of year. That's all coming up in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're changing gears now on The Exchange from the flu season to the foliage season. So join us with your observations of this year's display and your suggestions for the best leaf peeping. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also tell us on Twitter or Facebook, or send us your favorite foliage photo. We'll put it up on the Exchange website. With us for the last 10 minutes or so of the program is Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society, co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And Dave, it's always fun to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've written about what you call the fall foliage phenomenon, a big picture look at this annual show. What is the foliage phenomenon? First of all, Dave, from a pure ecological perspective, how do the trees do what they do?
Well, how it works is pretty simple, and we all learned this in biology class back in high school. Basically, chlorophyll breaks down in response to longer nights, and then there's an influence of weather and precipitation. And when the chlorophyll breaks down, that reveals the pigments that are masked, basically carotenoids that are orange or xanthophylls that are yellow, and those are revealed in the leaves every single year without fail. and then also in the presence of sunlight, sugars that are trapped in the leaves get converted to something called anthocyanin, which are the reds and the purples, and those give color to especially red maples and sugar maples. And we see that also in apples and blueberries and cranberries. These are just pigments that are in plants that are revealed when the chlorophyll goes away at the end of the growing season.
Okay, so just to review again for those of us who, you know, occasionally forget what they learned in middle school or elementary school, those colors are always there, but the green is the chlorophyll, and when that starts to go away, in reaction to less light.
In reaction to less light, longer nights, and then it's influenced by weather, by rainfall, and obviously what the weather is like during the season. That's pretty much the determinant. And every year there are variations, but they're pretty slight. And of course, it moves across the state from north to south. You can see these interactive foliage maps on Travel and Tourism's website. I would say the most important ingredient for foliage is forests. And it seems obvious, but we are extremely fortunate in New Hampshire. We're 84% forest, the second most forested state in the nation by land area. And having so much land and protected forest land drives the phenomenon of people pouring in to our backyards and our streets, and we have festivals and we have leaf peepers, and there's all this earnest speculation about whether it's going to be more or less brilliant, and then where is the place to go, the exact right spot to be.
Imagine there's no exact right spot. Right. But where are some good spots? For example, in this area, I often see my best foliage along the Merrimack River.
Right, along rivers, of course, where there's maples, off the interstates, back roads, small towns, places where you can stop. Somebody said to me recently on Facebook, it's like as if we're not even paying attention. And then one morning we wake up and it's all we can do to stay on the road. And even those of us who see it every single year are sort of surprised by, you know, the leaves popping, especially as we get near peak. Upcoming Columbus Day weekend is generally the peak foliage weekend in the southern White Mountains, the lakes regions, and central New Hampshire, the Upper Valley. But I laugh at that whole peak foliage thing. The whole leaf season reminds me of Groundhog Day. And, you know, as a self-proclaimed leaf expert and a tree geek, when the world beats a path to our door and asks us breathlessly about the foliage and is it going to be okay? Of course it's going to be spectacular. It always is. And there are variations from year to year.
Yeah. Now, hang on. You say it always is. I remember years where it's not so spectacular.
Well, memory is an imperfect thing, Laura. I mean, people have memories.
Wait, are you saying my memory is imperfect?
I'm not insinuating anything. But, I mean, we get wrapped up in the emotion and we try to, like, create variations on, well, was it a better year last year or was the year before that better? And how perfect is our memory of previous years? I will say that in the years that there is more bright, warm, sunny days and more sunlight working on the leaves and cool nights, we get more of the reds. And in years that are rainy, it's a more of what they call a pastel year. So you just sort of notice the contrasts of the yellow and the orange and the reds with the surrounding conifers. So that's another kind of phenomenon. This year, because it was a dry summer, red maple trees, which grow in swamps and wetlands and along rivers where you've noticed there's good foliage, were a little less stressed out because they weren't standing in water all summer. And so they tended to hold on to their green colors well into September. Often you'll see red maples turning in late August and early September. And they're just getting going at the end of September. So red maples were a little late this year, the swamp maples.
Yeah, I had noticed that in my own backyard, Dave. There's a big red maple. It's beautiful. And usually this time of year, it's brilliant. And honestly, there's one little tip that's red, and that's it. So before you talk about the drought and the impact on the foliage this year, let me remind everybody, we definitely want to hear from you in the next couple minutes. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Tell us about your favorite leaf peeping spot. Ask Dave Anderson your questions about the foliage this year. And of course, send us your favorite foliage photo. We'll put it up on the Exchange website. So go ahead, Dave. Judging from what you've been writing, you're a little aggravated with everybody calling you saying, is the foliage going to be bad this year because of the drought?
I'm actually pleased that the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, when people are concerned about forests and caring about forests and trees, it's a great day for us. You know, I've often said that New Hampshire could really make a little bit more hay while the sun shines when the world is coming to New England. World-renowned foliage. Unless we forget, last year, 9 million visitors spent an estimated $1.34 billion, with a B, dollars during the fall foliage season.
Just in New Hampshire.
Never mind Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts. We have the best foliage in the world. And people from outside the region want to know earnestly when they should time their visits and where they should go to see the fall foliage. And if you've been up to the White Mountains over Columbus Day weekend or some of the popular peaks, the peak of the hiking season at places like Mount Major in Alton or Mount Monadnock in Jaffrey in Dublin is during the fall foliage weekend when we have visitors from away coming to New Hampshire staying with us, and then we take them out to look at the leaves.
So drought this summer, good or bad?
Drought this summer, not really a significant influence. As long as we're
really
getting, we get longer nights every year. That's what gets the process going in the leaves. In response to longer nights, as long as we had green leaves in August and in September, trees that still had green leaves in September, all those leaves are going to turn. And so people look for some kind of a storyline each year, you know. Is it going to be more or less than last year? I'll tell you, the hurricane forecast this morning is that it's going to miss New England. That's good news for foliage because that's the one thing that can spoil the party. When we get wind-driven rain in October, a couple of days, and the trees have already formed that abscission layer where the leaves actually break off, that will blow away a lot of the color. The leaves fall off. I mean, that's going to happen eventually, but a prolonged season is not one where there's high wind and heavy rain. So it's really about the weather during the foliage season, not over the summer leading up to it.
But if a tree is stressed because of the drought over the summer, is it going to be capable of producing beautiful leaves?
It will produce. Well, that's more about next year's leaves, and the buds are already set for next year's forest.
So oh, really?
At the base of each leaf stem, the petiole, where that snaps off, is a little bud. In fact, they're losing their leaves in order to get through the winter and not dry out. The conifers have a different strategy. But the drought effect really is more about how, you know, vigorous the trees will grow in subsequent years. And I think trees are adapted, especially in New Hampshire. There's regional variations. Trees are adapted to the sites and soils that they grow in and the range of environmental conditions.
So are you saying, Dave, that the headlines about this year's drought means crummy foliage this year could be replaced by headlines of next year of last year's drought, the drought of 2016, could mean crappy foliage in 2017?
No, I would say that that whole concern of the drought was way overblown. I really think that if you look at the landscape right now, and if you talk to somebody relative to the rest of the world who is not familiar with what we take for granted, the foliage is stunning. I was driving around yesterday, and right at sunset, that sort of fluorescence that you see at sunset and the light being reflected off the leaves, it's just stunning out there right now.
So, Dave, how do you feel about foliage maps, foliage trackers, predictions for peak foliage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, I think those tools are important, and I think people look for something like that. They want to find out from the Division of Travel and Tourism, you know, about the timing of their visit and where to go. The foliage map shifts the colors moving southward from northwest to southeast. If you wanted to make an accurate foliage map for New Hampshire, you would look at elevation at a regional, very specific location. You would look at the influence of wetlands. You know, we joked about making a foliage map that included forest types by wetland, by slope, north-facing versus south-facing, and by elevation. And it would really look like, a Technicolor tapestry or calico print. It wouldn't have these bands of color moving.
What's the silliest question you've ever gotten about foliage?
Where can I see peak foliage? Where should I go to catch peak foliage?
Now, why is that silly?
Well, what if peak foliage arrives at 2 in the morning?
You mean that specific?
Right. I mean, and that's how we talk about it. I mean, these earnest questions. You know, if you miss it in Plymouth, can you race down to Keene and still catch it before it leaves that side of the state? I don't think there are silly questions. Again, you know, people caring about leaves and actually noticing and appreciating what we have. And it's also there's a psychological effect. When we see the foliage changing, it triggers some memories. In most people, we get a little wistful in the fall. And emotionally, we connect that with childhood. And we think about winter coming on. And it takes people by surprise, I think, even people who are pretty seasoned residents. And I think we should allow the foliage to take us by surprise and take a minute. Don't drive off the road, but to admire the trees in your yard and kind of anchor yourself in the year of where we are. It's pretty special. We have something that the rest of the world does not. It's very, very unique to New England.
Let's take a call, Dave. And Ken's joining us from Antrim. Hi, Ken, you're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, I just want one of my oak trees have been very prolific this year in their mount, and especially the size of the acorns. I actually had one come down and hit me in the neck, and it actually let the breeze.
Yeah, I've noticed the same thing. Ken, thank you for calling. I was out walking in the woods, Dave, and saw a huge amount of acorns this year. I thought, okay, we'll have some nice fat deer and bears this year.
Fat deer, bears, turkeys, foxes, obviously. It's a mast year. That's the strategy the oaks use. They'll put out all kinds of acorns for a couple of years and flood the market, overwhelm the primary seed predators, and that ensures that the species will continue. This is an oak mast year for red oaks and for white oaks, and they're like marbles underfoot in the forest. Great news for wildlife.
So mast year, is that what
mast,
you said?
Mast, it comes from the term to chew. And so that's what wildlife biologists describe nuts from the forest, beech nuts and acorns primarily now that we've lost chestnuts. There's also soft mast berries, apples. It's not a great apple year, but it's been an okay berry year. It also means that people who are hunting have to work a little harder to find wildlife.
Because they're so well fed.
They're farther back in the woods. They're not going to come to the cornfields or the orchards.
Well, Ken, it's a great question, and thank you. So, Dave, I'm afraid now to close out to tell you when peak foliage is. But how about where? Should I go? I've got some friends from out of town coming in. So.
Upper Valley, Merrimack Valley, White Mountains, Columbus Day weekend. The important thing is to be there, to get outside, to make time, because it will end with the wind-driven rain. And in 2 weeks, it will be past peak. So now is the time to appreciate how fortunate we are to have forests in New Hampshire.
It's been great to talk to you, Dave.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Laura.
So much.
Thank you very much.
Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society, co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.